Thank you, Dave. I thought for a minute I was going to have to go through my whole sermon backwards, which would have been interesting. But I'm not going to have to, which is good. Especially since I've kind of based this on a recipe thought. So I hope you had something to eat at least before you came out. You might be feeling peckish by the end. But this is a recipe for one great church here. And it doesn't serve 6 to 8. It doesn't serve 10 to 12. It serves everyone. The great church serves everyone. The problem I've got with this passage is I'm going to be covering the whole of Acts 20, and clearly that is too much to fit into a sermon, because there are bits where you could talk for well, like Paul, on and on so many bits. But what I'm going to do is just do a real canter through. It's going to be quite whistle stop. It's going to be it's going to be quite quick. And it's going to be quite high level. But the areas I'm going to cover are the ingredients, possibly. Not that way. Okay. There we go. I'm going to cover the ingredients for a great church as per Acts 20. And the ingredients are a large dose of word. Much word is required. Some silence, many tears, and extreme love. But before we get started, I think it's really valuable to just point out that we are partway through Paul's third missionary journey, and just want to kind of understand perhaps whereabouts Paul is. I've put Paul at the beginning in Antioch there, so that's where he started off from, and he made his way all the way along here to Ephesus, and he stopped in Ephesus for about 3 years. And then after he'd been in Ephesus, he whizzed up here, round there, back, and round there. And that's the bit we're going to look at today. I mean, do you want to see that again? Right, okay. He went up there, round there, and back. And that's where sort of Paul begins from. That there, that's where he starts this evening. That's his first goodbye. He says goodbye to the Ephesian church. Then he whizzes all the way round, and then he ends up back there, says goodbye to the leaders of the Ephesian church again. And then he makes his way on to Jerusalem. And then the next bit, which I haven't put in, is a bit where he goes off his captive journey from Jerusalem, eventually onto Rome. Now that journey, all told, was a period of about 4 years and covered about 2,700 miles. And as I say, it was 2 to 3 years in Ephesus to begin with. This kind of shows the time period that we're dealing with here. So he travels to Ephesus in AD 54. So Jesus has died, 20 odd years prior to this. Paul makes his way to Ephesus, third missionary journey. He's off there. He's collecting money for the church in Judea and Jerusalem, and then following that, he travels on to Philippi. It's quite high level, this, but he heads over to Corinth, Philippi, Miletus. He decides not to actually, although he says goodbye to the leaders in the church at Ephesus, he doesn't actually stop in the church at Ephesus. What he does is, I think he realised that there was no such thing as a short visit to the Ephesian church. I mean, the last time he's on a missionary journey, and he calls in there and he stays for 3 years. And he's keen to get to Jerusalem, so I think he was really keen to make his way right the way round. And he wanted to say goodbye, but he didn't want to get held up and stopped. He knew there was no such thing as a quick visit to the Ephesians. So the first ingredient, though, we're going to look at is that ingredient of much word. And that ingredient of much word kind of begins in Acts 20, verse 1. When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He travelled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people and finally arriving in Greece. Let's kind of picture the scene perhaps first off. He's been with this church for 3 years and he says to them, it's time for me to head on. And off he goes. And I would imagine that would have been a kind of fairly emotional departure. You know, that he hasn't said, I'm not coming back at this point. This is, you know, they're still thinking, oh, you know, we may well see Paul again. But of course, there's going to be no Twitter feeds from Paul while he's out. He's not going to be giving 140 character updates. He's not going to be updating his Facebook status constantly while he's on the move. And you can't even get hold of him, by phone or email or anything like that. So they know that he's going to be away and they're not going to know where he is and what he's up to. So they would have been quite sad as he left, I would think. And he speaks many words of encouragement to them, it says here. But I had a bit of a problem. It's probably just a bit of a hang up I've got with many words. I don't really like many words. I think probably most of us fall into that category. But if Paul said many good words, and of course that's fine, but I was quite comforted to read a sort of John Stott's commentary on this, and he said, it's kind of literally translated, it's like much word, and he spoke much word to the believers, much of God's word. One of the reasons, perhaps, that I've got a hang up on the phrase many words is, or something years and years ago, this is probably because I was thinking about people that had left with Paul leaving the Ephesian church, was a guy called Steve Dennis, who was a youth worker at this church, and he's gone on to do more youth work with another church. But I had a conversation with him, and the conversation was along the lines, we're both kind of fairly new at doing kind of standing up at the front and preaching and that kind of thing. And the conversation was really along the lines of, have you ever had that thing where you're standing up at the front of church and you're still talking, but you've got nothing to say? All the people know you've got nothing to say, and the words are just tumbling out of your mouth, and you're thinking, I've got nothing to say. And we kind of made it one of our kind of goals to try not to do that, to always have something to say. And when you've not got anything to say, just stop. And just end there. And the Bible gives us clear warnings about many words as well, doesn't it? In Ecclesiastes it says, do not be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. And Jesus, of course, described the Gentiles' prayer as well, didn't he? He said, and when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that it will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So I'm going to be cautious about the number of words that I use, even though I think that is quite a... that's an excuse for a really long sermon to have your first point as many words, isn't it? But the thing I want to hone in on, perhaps, is the fact that these are words of encouragement. And this is the ingredient, this is the essential ingredient for the church. It isn't just words, it is a specific sort of words. You see, when you're making something, when you're making something following a recipe, it's very important that you get the right kind of, ingredient. In fact, I've got quite a good example. I had Sunday lunch today at my mother in law's, unfortunately Jane's gone out, I had Sunday lunch today at my mother-in-law's house, and my father-in-law had bought the flour for the Yorkshire puddings. He'd bought the wrong sort of flour, and we had Yorkshire pancakes, instead of Yorkshire puddings. But this is the thing with words, isn't it? It's the wrong sort of word doesn't encourage, it does not make the church grow. It's really unhelpful. Nothing strengthens and encourages God's people like much of his word. And it's important to remember that Paul's mission here was not just about fresh Christians. It wasn't just about evangelizing, creating new believers, but it was also about strengthening existing Christians. And the way to do that was with much word. And that's something I think we can do well to remember when we're here on a Sunday evening, or we kind of struggle out to our small group, or to any other Bible study that we're doing, or meeting another believer, or even if it's just flicking a believer a text or giving them a phone call. It's so encouraging. It really does build our spiritual muscles, and allows us to act in a way that is godly throughout the week. And if you don't want a kind of physical analogy, perhaps much word could be described as a sunshine and rain that pours on the believer and allows the fruit of the Spirit to grow, that love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Now, Luke's much word goes from the much word of his goodbyes and travelling around encouraging the church to where he lands up in Troas, and he's there with Eutychus in the window. Now, this really is an example of many words. I mean, Paul departs from the narrative of his of the journey to tell us about this. And there must have been so many interesting things that happened. So many things are missed out, aren't they? But this is included. And sometimes I wonder why. Whether it is just because it is such a remarkable account. Now, a little bit about Eutychus. Eutychus, according to the commentators, was probably a lad. Well, he was a lad, we know that. But aged between 18 and 14. Okay? And it's a slave name. And the slave name apparently, because I don't know, but I'm trusting N.T. Wright here, and he does know, and he says it means lucky. And I'll tell you what, I don't know if he's lucky or unlucky, but I think at the end of the story, he's lucky, isn't he, really? And I think, to be honest, it's a story that I can certainly relate to, not being a first century slave, obviously, but the fact that here he is, a guy. It's an evening meeting, and he's there. He's had a hard day at work, and he's in that third story window. It's going to be a packed house, and it's a warm climate, and the oil lamps are on, and it's that kind of orangey yellow glow, and the smell of the burning oil, and Paul's going on, and then all of a sudden, of course, he just can't stay awake anymore. He's overcome by sleep. And that's the phrase used in the translations, isn't it? It's overcome by sleep. I think there are some lessons we can draw from here, some principles we can draw from here. There are some one-off things that we can't draw. It's no point in saying, oh, yeah, principles of worship should be we have oil lamps, or we can't draw from the account that we must have supersized sermons every week, thankfully. But we can draw some thoughts, and the first, perhaps, is the fact that as Paul's talking on and on, the commentators say that the word used is more akin to discussion. They use the word, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it, but they use the word that's Greek for discussion, uses that twice, and they use the word for conversation once. And I think that shows a really valuable principle that we should adhere to about talking about the word and discussing it with people, and especially with someone like Paul, but with our elders in our church and with our groups, just talking about the word. I think it's really important here that Paul doesn't treat this incident as a rebuke for talking too long. You know, he doesn't kind of say, and the point is, I won't go on that long again. No, he doesn't let Eutychus get away with it. He's fallen out the window, he's died, and you might be thinking, did he really die? Well, I reckon he did, because it says so in the Bible, and the reason I'd put some stay on that is that firstly, we've got Luke, who's writing this. Luke's a historian, and he records things accurately. Secondly, Luke, who records this, is a doctor. So he is a medical doctor, and he knows about when someone's dead, or if they're in a stupor, or if they're unconscious, or anything like that. And also, just because I'm human, I reckon that falling out of a third-story window when you're not ready for it, this isn't a dangle, lower yourself down, climb down, find the most soft place to land. This is a sitting in the window, dropping off to sleep, falling out. This is, I don't find it hard to believe that he died when he hit the deck. It's just not hard to believe. So anyway, the point is that wasn't an excuse to get out the rest of the sermon, was it? So Paul brings him back to life. It would have just been such a sickening feeling, I think, being in that room at the time. Would he have woken up? Would he have, as he fell, would it be like that falling dream where you suddenly sort of wake up with a jolt in bed? But of course he didn't. I mean, did he actually call out as he fell? Did he actually kind of realise he was going and then call out? Or was he just asleep all the way till he hit the ground, thump? And was that when people noticed that kind of, where's Eutychus gone? It would just be the worst feeling. And then Paul, he makes his way out there, and he's got it all in hand, and he stretches himself out over Eutychus in the same way that Elijah does in the Old Testament. He stretches himself out over the widow's son when he dies. A very dramatic, very powerful picture. And the believers go on to celebrate the Lord's Supper and remember Jesus being raised from the dead. And although this point is about much word, I think that it's important to remember that God speaks to believers and not yet believers through the word as it's read, as it's explained in the Bible, but also through the actions and lives of godly men and through the signposts of the sacraments. So the breaking of the bread reminds us about Jesus' death, and baptism points us towards towards Jesus, and it's that representation, that kind of outward show that we of new life, and that we believe in Jesus. So it comes to us through Scripture audibly, comes to us through Scripture visibly, and it comes to us through the actions of God's people, through Elijah there in the Old Testament and the widow's son, through Paul there in the New Testament, and from you, from me, which is remarkable. But from our actions, people become believers. We're a part of that. Now, while there is a place, and an essential place in Christianity for much word, it's really important to remember that it's a religion of action, not a religion of just talking. And people should know that there's something different about us by our actions. I don't mean that we should feel that we have to be able to bring someone back from life, back to life. But I do think that there are two things worth mentioning that I just can't cover. But the first thing that I think is worth mentioning in terms of actions is the way that we treat life events. So this guy, Eutychus, has fallen out the window. Paul doesn't say it's Eutychus' fault because he should have been more awake and on the ball when he was listening to his sermon. He doesn't say that at all. Paul doesn't say it was his fault for talking too long and he should have stopped. He doesn't say it was the homeowner's fault for not having decent ventilation and no proper guards up at the window. The long and short of it is just sometimes bad things happen and it's not actually anybody's fault. You know, none of the individuals in this account, it's none of their fault. And the reaction of the believer should be something that shows us as different to the world. The Lord gives and the Lord takes us away and we need to be able to, you know, lift our eyes up to the Lord, not in an unemotional way, not in a detached way, but with many tears, but with a reaction that knows that God is in fact in control. And in addition to those actions, it's also very clear from the scriptures that we must be willing to help the helpless and the poor and the widow and the orphan. And this whole mission is gathering money for the church in Jerusalem and Judea. That's part of the purpose. In fact, that's why Paul sets out in the first place. So, and in the Old Testament, in fact, it says there should be no poor among you. And therefore, we can see that this is Christianity is a religion of action. And so, as I say, while much word is important, it's not the only thing. Okay, the second ingredient that we're gonna look at is some silence. So there was much word, and after much word saying goodbye, and after much word in Troas, we're back on the narrative of the journey, and we see Paul heading back to Assos. Now, I've got a picture for this as well, so not that way. Okay. So what we've got here is that little loop. I mean, essentially what happens here is from verse 13 we see that Dr. Luke went on ahead to the ship and sailed for Assos, where we were going to take Paul abroad. He made this arrangement because he was going there on foot. When he met us at Assos, we took him aboard and went to Mytilene. Then the next day we set sail from there and arrived at Chios, and the day after that we crossed over to Samos, and the following day at Miletus. Paul decided to sail past Ephesus to avoid spending time there in the province of Asia. He was in a hurry to reach Jerusalem, if possible, by the day of Pentecost. So the point here is that Paul and the Assos bit is just this little bit from Troas to Assos. So Troas is just there, and Assos slightly below, and you can see that you could save your legs by catching the boat down there, or you could walk down, and Paul chose to walk. And the nature of the nature of the writing here is Dr. Luke says we went on ahead of the ship, which seems to imply that Paul took this bit on his own. He just went on his own for the rest of it, for this bit. Now, it's kind of interesting because Paul is with a big old crowd. In verse 4, the crowd that Paul's with is listed out. We've got Soptus and Epirus from Berea, Aristarchus, Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy, and also Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. A diverse bunch. And I'm sure a great encouragement to Paul. I mean, we all know that you need to have people with you. You need that kind of encouragement. I recently did some decorating at home, and I was really fortunate that my uncle came up from Devon to help me out. And it was such an encouragement. I would never have got as much done if he hadn't been there. Not only because I was able to learn from his expertise, and I was kind of getting a few tricks of the trade and all that kind of thing, but the fact that he was there meant I didn't stop for a cup of tea every 3 minutes. Do you know what I mean? And I had to do it. You know, I knew that he was coming, and I had to do it. And of course, a very similar thing for Paul and those other missionaries that were with him. In addition to that, you know, they need a sustainable mission, so they needed other people to be trained up. So Paul needed to have other missionaries with him so they could see how it was done, so they could go on and do the very same thing. Also, it was dangerous times. Not only have we got hardline Jews trying to kill Paul left, right and centre, but we've also got the fact that he was collecting money. So he was at risk from just general bandits who wanted a buck, you'd presume. And then, because I've been working in audit for far too long, I think there's a governance issue here, where you've got a fella coming up to you and say, hey, yeah, I'll take your money and I'll take it to Jerusalem, and there's no separation of duties. You need to have somebody there to go, yeah, he took that money and then he gave it to the church at Jerusalem. And that kind of thing's important, I think. But I would, that's what I do. But back to some silence. So the passage implies that Paul travelled alone here. I can only really speculate as to why he would have travelled alone, why he would have done that. But it is hard to get that downtime. It is hard to get that time when we're alone with God in a noisy world. But it's so important. And I think it would have been important to Paul because it was an example that was set by Jesus. He would retire alone to pray. And it would have been imperative for Paul to do the same. And in addition to the some silence, there are times when it's not right actually for much words, and it's time for tears. And the time for tears here is when Paul says goodbye to the leaders at the Ephesus church. See, words have run out, really, and they know they're not going to see Paul again, and so they're upset. You know, they've loved Paul. Paul has spent that time with them, and Paul's loved them because he's been there, and he's been telling them about Jesus, and he so wants them to know the truth of the gospel that he he explains it with tears. Words just aren't enough. And these tears really demonstrate a kind of an extreme love. It demonstrates Ephesians' love for Paul, what he meant to them. And we see that Paul cries as he was leaving and as he proclaimed the word to them. This is really a kind of, I think, like it's like parental love. This is the kind of tears you cry when you're praying for your children. And it should remind us, whether you've got kids or not, it should remind us of the kind of love we should have for our church family. Again, this is an area that you could do a whole sermon on. I could easily do a whole sermon on. But I think it's really worth just noting as a point, because I just haven't got time to do it. And the point is this, that we are a church family. And we all know that we don't choose our family. And we all know that within our family, there are some people we get on with better than others. But we still love them. And I think one of our big issues, one of my big issues perhaps, you can talk to me afterwards if you don't think this is a big issue, but we live in a consumer culture. And our lives are so often about getting value for money and getting a bargain, the most bangs for your buck, all that kind of thing. And that's important, and it would be ridiculous of me to argue against good stewardship. That would be stupid, okay? So I'm not arguing against that. But what I am saying is that within a family, you don't think of things in the same way. If you want to say well done to someone, you go up to them and you say, well done. That was really good. I really enjoyed what you did. The Sunday School of Rock was today, wasn't it? It was brilliant. It was so good. And so I know loads of you will be going up and saying well done to the guys that were involved in that. And I know that if you've got a question about something, you'll go and ask someone. So, I didn't understand that. Can you tell me about it? And if you're unhappy about something, then you don't phone up customer services and you don't say, are my statutory rights going to be affected by making this complaint? No, that's what you do in a consumer purchase. It's not what you do within a family. And the tears here, the tears that Paul sheds, are tears because he loved the church, because they were his family. And the tears that the church at Ephesus shed were for Paul because he loved them. That's his family. And Paul knows what's going to happen next as well. You see, Paul knows that he's not coming back and that the wolves are coming to that church. And the wolves are the people that are going to come along and distort the truth that Paul has spoken. Now, Paul knows very well that wolves love lambs. Wolves absolutely love lambs. Not in the same way that shepherds love lambs, in an entirely different way. And that's why he gives them such a stark warning. And he kind of feels it's necessary to remind the church there of his nature, of Paul's own nature, and of his love for them. You see, it's a kind of weird address in one way. He says, therefore, this is in verse 26, therefore I declare to you today that I'm innocent of the blood of all men, for I've not hesitated to proclaim to you the whole will of God. Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church which he brought with his own blood. I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come among you. And the point is, he says, I declare to you today that I am innocent of the blood of all men. Well, he spent 3 years with his church. They should know that already. But he knows what's going to come in after him. It's going to be people arguing things and saying that Paul got it wrong. And that Paul was not who he said he was, or Paul didn't have it buttoned down. It's almost like an introduction, almost like a CV paragraph. I think it's sort of like, well, at this church, I did this, or a speaker's biography. You know, he's written down, you know, I've done these things, I've done those things. But the church at Ephesus should know that, because he did it with them. But he needs to do it to remind them who Paul is and whose interests he's got at heart. You see, for me, this argument is the bit that reminds the church at Ephesus, or aims to remind the church at Ephesus, of that that kind of logic argument that happens in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And I love this as an illustration. You've got that scene in A Lion, a Witch and a Wardrobe. Lucy's gone into the wardrobe, she's discovered Narnia, and comes back, and everyone says, no, you're crackers, and that's that. And then she goes into the wardrobe again, and Edmund follows her, and she comes out, and her and Edmund both know that Narnia exists. And Lucy goes up to Peter and says, hey, I've been back to Narnia, I'm not mad as a bicycle, I am actually totally sane, Edmund saw it as well. And Edmund goes, no, I didn't. And then, like, there's a kind of an argument in the story, and the professor, kind of wades in and speaks to Peter and says, look, what's the argument about? And Peter says, well, you know, Lucy's, sop is a box of frogs. It kind of goes through this logical argument. So Peter says she's obviously mad. And the professor says, well, why is she obviously mad? And he says, well, you know, she says there's a country in the back of the wardrobe. And she says, well, does Lucy have a propensity to lying? Well, no, she's a very truthful person. Okay, what about Edmund? Yeah, well, Edmund's a bit more shady. So who would you believe then? Who would you believe? Would you believe the person you know is a truth teller or the person you think is a liar? Even if the truth does sound strange. And you might say to me, Phil, that's a fine analogy in a book, but is that a valid way to describe true life experience? And I think that it is absolutely a valid way to describe true life experience. I can describe it from my own growing up in a Christian home where my parents are believers, and they said to me, you know, Jesus is King. But I didn't believe them, so I went and followed the world. Why would you do that? It's kind of rubbish logic. But you do it because the call of the world is so loud, and you forget that your parents aren't naive, and they didn't want harm for me. They only wanted good. So you think, why? Why would you ever argue against that logic? Why don't you realise? And this is the key thing that Paul is doing here. He's saying, look, you know me, so whatever anybody else comes back and says, remember who I am. You might say to me, Phil, your logic is still flawed because every parent wants their wants their children to be the same as them. So if you've got a Muslim parent, then they will say, Muhammad is the greatest prophet. And so not all parents can be right by your argument. And that is absolutely right. It's absolutely right. And the Bible holds itself up to be tested. You have to own your faith. But if you don't listen and explore for yourself, then you can't own it. Peter says that you must be able to give reason for the hope that you have. You must own that faith. In Thessalonians it says, test everything and hold on to the good. So if a person's got something to say, then listen respectfully, then check it out. But don't be swayed by the Edmunds who are saying that it doesn't exist, and don't listen to the words that are spoken the most or the loudest, but the ones that you know are true. Look, it's my final point here. Nobody knowingly dies for a lie. Nobody knowingly dies for a lie. The Apostle Paul was a top Pharisee. He was awesome at Christian killing. He was awesome at disrupting the church. He was well liked. He was high profile. He was a celebrity. He had everything. And what did he do? He went and became a tent maker and teacher. Ends up beaten up, naked, shipwrecked, despised by the people that once absolutely loved him. And why? Why? It's because of Jesus' extreme love for his people. It's because Jesus came to save the lost, not to administer medicine to healthy people, but to administer medicine to the sick, to come and save the sick. And that's it. That is the essential and unmissable ingredient in the church that serves everyone. It's Jesus. And it's on that note that we stand and sing our final hymn. Dave, can you flick to verse 3? It's Jesus, your blood and righteousness. And this song reminds us that it was Jesus' blood and his perfect life that saves us from hell. And it says in verse 3, it's such great picture language, when from the dust of death I rise to claim my home beyond the skies, then this shall be my only plea, that Jesus lived